So hello, my talk will be about neutrino cosmology and large-scale structure, and I will mostly talk about two different questions. So one of them is how can we obtain robust neutrino measurements from cosmology, and how can we test neutrino physics with cosmology? And so this is the outline of my talk. So at first, I will give an introduction to neutrinos and cosmology. Then I will talk about neutrinos and dark energy, then about time-varying neutrino masses, and then about relativistic effects in large-scale structure that could affect neutrino mass constraints in the future. So I would like to start with some open questions about neutrinos, and these are, of course, not all open questions of neutrinos, only some of them. So for example, there's this question, how many different neutrino types exist? That means if there are any additional neutrinos, so for example, sterile neutrinos. Then there's this question, how the neutrino masses are actually generated, because the standard model of particle physics does not explain this yet. And then the cosmology mostly is interested in the question, what is the sum of the neutrino masses? And related to that is the question, what are the individual neutrino masses? And in this talk, I will talk about the first three questions and not about this one. So cosmology is mostly looking at two different neutrino parameters. One is the effective number of neutrinos, parameterized through an effective, and then the total neutrino mass sum. And I put a question mark here for the individual neutrino masses. So this is how an effective is parameterized. So neutrinos contribute to the radiation density at very early times. So this is the contribution of photons, and this is the contribution of neutrinos. So this number comes from that neutrinos are fermions. And this accounts for the temperature difference between photons and neutrinos. And the standard model prediction for an effective is not exactly 3, it is 3.046. And that accounts for entropy transfer between the plasma and neutrinos, because neutrinos don't decouple instantaneously. So it would be free if they decouple instantaneous. And here you can see how an effective affects the CMB temperature and isotropy power spectrum. So here I have plotted the CLs for different values of an effective. And you can see that, for example, the first peak here is increased a lot, and that the scale of this peak is changed. And that comes mostly from a change in the matter radiation equality when changing an effective. There are other effects as well. So for example, this tail of the CMB temperature anisotropy spectrum can be damped by an effective. And also an effective modulates the abundance of light elements produced in BBN, and this can further dampen this tail. Then the current constraints on an effective is very close to 3, as you can see here from the final Planck release from this year. There's an additional constraint from BBN that says that delta an effective should be below 1. And now I want to shift to the sum of neutrino masses. So in this plot, you can see the percentage difference in the matter power spectrum. So the reference power spectrum is here, the power spectrum where all neutrinos are massless. And so for example, this curve is for a total neutrino mass sum of 100 millielectron volt, and this is for 300 millielectron volt. And you can see that for a higher neutrino mass, the power spectrum is suppressed more. And yeah?
So when you play neutrinos, it's only left handed that we are talking about, right?
Yeah. So this comes from that neutrinos free stream out of density fluctuations. And therefore, they don't contribute to the clustering of matter when they are still free streaming. And the other obstacle the clustering of cold dark matter and baryon. And here you can see the different neutrino hierarchies allowed. So this is the normal hierarchy, and this is the inverted hierarchy. And so far, neutrino oscillation experiments have measured these mass differences here. However, they have measured the square here, and not exactly the mass difference itself. And that then leads to two different hierarchies, depending on whether this is positive or negative. And with current data, it is not possible yet to distinguish between these different neutrino hierarchies. There are hints from the Super-Kamiokande experiment for the normal hierarchy at the moment. And there are a couple of constraints on the total neutrino mass sum. So for example, when you think of the neutrino hierarchies that I showed you before, you can just add the mass differences together, and then you can obtain lower limits on the total neutrino mass sum. So this is for the normal hierarchy, and this is for the inverted hierarchy. And then there is an upper limit from tritium beta decay experiments that constrains the electron neutrino mass to be below 2.2 electron volt. And then the current upper limit from the final Planck data release from this year is 120 millielectron volt. However, this is a limit assuming lambda ZDM plus neutrino masses. So this is a model dependent constraint. And in this plot, you can see the expectation for future neutrino experiments. So this shows the current cosmology limits on the total neutrino mass sum, although this is for the Planck 2015 data release and not for the one from this year. So you can see here a limit of around 200 millielectron volt. Then this shows the predicted sensitivity of the Katrin experiment in Germany that has just started to take data. And the lower sensitivity is 200 millielectron volt for the electron neutrino mass. Now, if you think of the limit that I have shown to you before from cosmology, that is already 120 millielectron volt. So that is lower than the sensitivity here. And that could mean that there could be problems here. So that it might be difficult to observe neutrinos here in this case, if the cosmological limit is valid. And then here you can see predictions for the CMB stage 4 experiment combined with DZBAO. So for the normal hierarchy, it is expected that this combination will be able to detect the total neutrino mass with 3 sigma.
Quick question.
Yes?
Can I understand why the constraint doesn't depend on the neutrino mass?
Sorry?
Like here, the CMB constraints don't really depend on the absolute mass of the neutrino. Is that because they're just bounds or they're actual mass? If it were this, that would be the error bar.
Well, I think in the future, like cosmology data will actually be sensitive to the individual neutrino masses, but not so much.
Oh, I see. Sorry.
It's just with current data. It's complicated.
That's the lightest. I see.
Yeah, and then so probably if you get then a limit that is below 100 millielectron volt, you can then exclude the inverted hierarchy just because of the limit.
This actually should have stayed flat all the way to like 1 electron volt.
Which line, sorry?
Oh. So the green region.
Once the lightest one gets heavy enough, then I guess it's got to come on.
Yeah.
It's just the way they made the plot.
Yeah. So for very high masses, both the inverted and the normal hierarchy, they so the same, but just because they are very close to a degenerate neutrino hierarchy. So now I want to talk about the question whether certain dark energy models could actually mimic the behavior of neutrinos and therefore could affect neutrino mass constraints. So this is a plot also from a forecasting paper. So these are forecasts for CMB stage 4 combined with DZ. And here on this axis, you can see the standard deviation of the total neutrino mass sum for different models. So this is lambda CDM plus the total neutrino mass sum. This is if you include, in addition, an effective, so allow an effective to vary. This is when you include curvature, and this is when you allow the equation of state parameter of dark energy to vary. So you can see here that the red region goes around here, and then if we follow this line, this would then correspond to a 4 sigma detection of the total neutrino mass sum from cosmology. Then when we include, when we allow an effective to vary, this is a bit higher, and then this would correspond to only a 3 sigma detection. And then we allow the equation of state factor of dark energy to vary, we would be here, and this would be a 1 sigma detection, so hardly a detection anymore.
So the information being used is what exactly? So this is is this CMU lensing or?
I think it's CMB plus CMB lensing plus DZBAO.
Like, so KSE, for example, like, is that being used?
Sorry?
Is the kinetic semi-annual solution effect also? I mean, I'm just curious, like, what exactly is this problem? So,
By DESI, though,
so you would just mean DAO?
Yeah.
So not just space distortions?
Yeah, to my knowledge, this means DAO, yeah. So when we want to understand why this is happening, we need to look at the behavior of both neutrinos and dark energy through different epochs of the cosmic time. So in this plot, you can see what is happening with neutrinos. So this shows the equation of state factor of neutrinos, and this is the fraction of energy density of neutrinos to the total energy density. So neutrinos behave as radiation at very early times, and when they become non-relativistic, they behave as cold dark matter. And therefore, the energy density of neutrinos can be described in two regimes. So the first one is the equation that I have shown to you before, so that you can describe the energy density in terms of an effective. The second one is when my neutrinos are non-relativistic, and then it can be described in terms of a total neutrino mass sum. And this here is the redshift when actually neutrinos become non-relativistic, and as you can see, it depends on the neutrino mass. And this is plotted here for two different neutrinos. So for one that has a mass of 100 millielectron volt, and one that has a mass of 60 millielectron volt. And you can see that the neutrino with this smaller mass becomes non-relativistic later. And at first, we have an equation of state factor of around, of 1/3, and then they become non-relativistic. This goes to zero, as it is for cold dark matter. And then we can add in this plot two different dark energy components. And we were looking here specifically at barotropic dark energy and early dark energy because they look so similar to neutrinos. So barotropic dark energy means that the pressure of this dark energy component can be described as fully as a function of its energy density. And the interesting behavior of that component is that it has the same equation of state factor as neutrinos for a long period of time, and then it goes to the equation of state factor of a cosmological constant. But for this whole time, it behaves the same as neutrinos here. And then early dark energy means that there is an amount of dark energy that can't be neglected at very early times. So this is what you can see here. And this dark energy component has very similar energy density compared to the energy density of neutrinos at intermediate time. And in this plot, you can also see a couple of observations that we use to measure neutrino parameters. So this is so at a redshift of 1,100, the CMB decouples. Then from this time to today, we have CMB lensing. And then to around a redshift of 3, large-scale structure observations. So this means, in this case, mostly baryonic acoustic oscillations. So what we did first was then to look at these two models with blank CMB data, but at this stage only with temperature data, not with polarization data. So we varied here neutrino parameters, that means in this case an effective, because this model will be degenerate with an effective. And in this case, we varied the total neutrino mass sum because this model will be degenerate with the total neutrino mass sum. And here we varied the amount of barotropic dark energy at early times, and here the amount of early dark energy at early times. And then both of these parameter combinations. And here you can see the strong degeneracy between barotropic dark energy and an effective. So in that case, you could, for example, obtain lower values of an effective, but obtain very high values of this barotropic dark energy component. And you can see a similar thing here, that you obtain a very high value of early dark energy, but a very small value for the total neutrino mass sum. So they are very degenerate here.
And they don't look very degenerate. It just looks like a perfectly round error counter.
You mean the early dark energy?
Yeah, the early dark.
Yeah, but, so the degeneracies are higher for the barotropic dark energy.
Right, it looks bad.
And we quantified how degenerate they are for, by looking at correlation coefficients.
But if you add more parameters to your dark energy model, and at some point you get a perfect degeneracy or no, using these observations?
Probably. So for this model, we added one new parameter, and I think for this, two. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just wondering, I mean, well, right, so if you let the dark energy just to totally arbitrary behavior, you know, would you get like an exact degeneracy or not?
And I think you don't see an exact degeneracy here when you look at the correlation coefficient, so it was not like 100%.
So if I may, so there's some literature on this. So the thing about how can it usually assume to be a perfect fluid, but of course, neutrinos are not. So, if you assume dark energy to be a perfect fluid, no matter what the question is, it can never be exactly degenerate because it doesn't cause anisotropic stress, which has the same measure in the same reactivity. It's not as bad. Yes, that's the earlier time.
Yeah. I guess I was wondering for like late time effects.
Yeah, but I think these are early time effects. The barotropic dark energy is an early time effect.
Yes. Yeah. So what we did then was to include late time probes, but so at first CMB lensing that tests the period between CMB decoupling and today, and then baryonic acoustic oscillations. And as you can see here, this does not break the degeneracy so well for the case of barotropic dark energy, because this barotropic dark energy component is so similar to neutrinos mostly at early times. So you would need to measure better the early times here to distinguish the better component, the two components. However, in the case of early dark energy, you see that adding BAO information helps to break these degeneracy. And then we perform forecasts for the two models, and you see a similar behavior as before. So with future CMB data, so CMB stage 4, you can measure an effective much better and also restrict the amount of barotropic dark energy much better. In this case, for early dark energy, also CMB lensing and baryonic acoustic oscillations will be really helpful. And now I want to talk.
Just skip this slide.
No, I was accidentally going to the next game. Oh. Sorry.
Don't worry.
Stop us there.
So I now want to talk.
What? There used to be the Blind Mahalpa Forest was also a competitor.
No, it's not. I think it would, but we have not looked at it. Yeah. So now I want to talk about a different project that I have been doing, and that is about the question whether new neutrino physics could actually be hidden in cosmological tensions. And for that, I would like you to look at these two plots. So you have probably heard of the sigma 8 omega matter tensions that are shown in this plot here. So this shows the weak lensing constraints from the kilo degree survey and the Planck 2015 constraint. And as you can see here, these counters and these, they do barely overlap. And this is around a 2 sigma tension, so not as such a high tension actually yet. And there is a similar tension when you look at Planck SZ cluster counts and the CMB, and this is shown in this plot here. So these are the constraints on sigma 8 and omega matter for different mass priors. And this here, the black dashed curve, is the CMB. So now these effects could come from systematic errors in the analysis of weak gravitational lensing data, or also in Planck, or they could come from new physics model. And so it might well be that this is systematics, and therefore I have included here a warning line so that you should take all the results that I'm showing you then with the knowledge that this can well be systematics. There was a paper a couple of years ago that looked at the total neutrino mass sum for different data combinations. So this black curve is when you look only at CMB data combined with baryonic acoustic oscillation. So this stands for WMAP. And then you include lensing data on top of that, and this means in this case weak lensing data. This curve shifts a bit to the right, and then you include a Z cluster counts on top of that, you see that it shifts even further to the right, so that you would get a much higher neutrino mass constraint. And therefore, we were wondering if this is not systematic, so again, think of this warning line here, whether it could actually be that the neutrino mass is very small at early times and is then increasing over time and larger at late times. So that the CMB would observe a lower value of the total neutrino mass, as for example, as SZ cluster counts. So there was previously a model that suggested such behavior. And that was originally suggested to explain the cosmological coincidence problem. That means originally that the energy density of cold dark matter and dark energy are so similar today. And within a redshift of a few, also that the neutrino densities and the dark energy density here are very similar. However, it has been shown that this model was not stable, and that also it would not be distinguishable from a cosmological constant. Therefore, in our project, we actually looked at a different model that was developed by Lena here. So we were motivated by this model, but so it is not exactly the model we were considering because we did a couple of assumptions. So for example, in the model, both a first order and a second order phase transition would be allowed, but we consider here a first order phase transition. Also, we considered here a degenerate neutrino mass hierarchy because we look at such high neutrino masses, but the degenerate neutrino mass hierarchy would still be okay. And then also the model predicts that there would be neutrino annihilations and neutrino self interactions, and we have neglected them in our analysis here in order just to study the isolated effect of this phase transition. So the way we have implemented this is to include a step function for the individual neutrino masses, so that the neutrinos are massless at first and then at a scale factor AS, so the scale factor of the phase transition, they obtain the mass that they have today. And then in order to keep energy conserved, we also included a false vacuum energy that has a certain value before the phase transition, but we determined as the difference of the energy densities of massive and massless neutrinos. And that then at the time of the phase transition, turns into the neutrino masses, and therefore this energy density is zero then. So in this plot, you can actually see how this looks like then. So this here is the standard dark energy component. This is matter. Then this is radiation. And then we have neutrinos here. So you see they behave as massless particles at first, and then at the time of the phase transition, they obtain their mass, and then they behave as cold dark matter. And these dashed lines are for later phase transition. So this is for a redshift of 10, and this is when the phase transition happens at a redshift of 0.5. So that means if when we have a very early phase transition, that this false vacuum energy could be dominant over the standard dark energy. And when we have a very late phase transition, that this false vacuum energy would not be dominant over the energy from a cosmological constant. And so here in this plot, you can see the impact of this model on the CMB.
Yeah. I guess one thing I would worry about is, if you have a phase transition which is so abrupt, then it would be also very homogeneous.
I guess you're assuming it's very homogeneous, but as we know in nature, if you have first order phase transition, it happens in bubbles, which are very homogeneous, right?
But if you have it at a very small scale, it's like the electronal scale, the internal scale of the transition, this is like corresponding to millimeter inhomogeneity. So on a large cosmological scale, like the overall inhomogeneity is small.
Okay. So in this plot, you can see the effects of this model on the CMB temperature anisotropy power spectrum. So for different values of ZS, but so for different redshifts of the phase transition. So this is at a redshift of 1,000, then we have 100 and 10. So if we have this phase transition already at a redshift of 1,000, it means that this case is very similar to the standard massive neutrino case, because for most of the evolution, when these neutrinos have their mass. However, if this phase transition happens really late, at this redshift of 10, for example, then they are massless for most of the time. So then this red curve is very similar to the standard massive neutrino case. And then the other curves reflect that the neutrinos are then massless for most of their evolution. So you see features then in the small L range and in the large L range. And you won't be able to distinguish then, this effect for the very small L because you are cosmic variance limited. And you see the most effect when in the matter power spectrum, especially when you look here at the percentage difference between these different models. So as I told you before, massive neutrinos suppress the matter power spectrum. Now, if the neutrinos are massless for most of their evolution and obtain the mass later, that means that some of the suppression is reversed, and therefore that the power spectrum amplitude is then higher as before. And this is what you can see here. So when we have a very late phase transition, the suppression of the power spectrum is less as compared to the standard massive neutrino case, which is our reference model here. So, and in this plot, you can see.
Sorry,
yeah?
Go back to this.
Yeah.
So, which one is the standard one and which one is the
model? So, in this case, you don't see a line for the standard case because I'm plotting here the percentage difference. So, the reference model is the standard massive neutrino case here. And it is also plotted in this here, but because the differences are so small, you cannot see it so much here.
So the reference is the standard with the same sum of neutrino?
Yes, exactly.
So what's held fixed, you know, during this? I mean, like, do you hold fixed the momentum distribution of the neutrinos at the time of the transition?
So. Everything that I was changing when creating this plot was just the time of the phase transition, and I kept everything else.
The transition, right. So you know, suddenly acquire arrest mats.
Mm-hmm.
They have the same momentum before and after. Is this like, so is that what's being done, or?
Yeah, but maybe we become
more. Yeah. Right.
It's a larger.
You'll fold. Right.
So like, okay, so that's the calculation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy then to see like why does this like behavior for like the orange curve? Is that a glitch in your calculation or like where's that real like this oscillating?
This goes up and down.
Yeah.
What do you mean exactly? Sorry.
This thing that this goes up and down like the orange thing. Orange.
I'm not sure, but I think it might be a slight change in the turnover scale of the matter power spectrum. I'm not sure exactly myself about this feature.
Do you mean because k non-relativistic
changes? Yeah, possibly.
This is determined by the mass, but in our case, it's determined by the point of the phase transition. Because
yeah.
This is the moment where the neutrinos become non-relativistic. And usually, this is just given by the mass. And in our case, it's like unrelated to the absolute amount. So I guess this is the region where it's inversed on some scales of the part of it.
It is mysterious, I don't know. But why, it's a very sharp feature.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Why is there a sharp feature? I mean, I'm not sure if you have an explanation.
Why is it sharp feature in the case space? So we haven't actually thought about it before, so we just took
mm-hmm.
the simulation at the mm-hmm. output so far. But yes, I would expect that in the standard case, because it's in comparison to the standard case, there K non-relativistic is connected to the neutrino mass inherently.
Mm-hmm.
And in our case, the K where the neutrinos become non-relativistic is given by the phase transition but not early masses. So we have this intermediate point, which where compared to the standard case, the behavior is opposite on the left and the right hand side.
Oh. So this plot shows some of our preliminary results. So you can see here, the dark blue is the standard massive neutrino case. And then our model, because we have a supercooled phase transition, it is here called supercooled nu. And these are the light blue curves in here. And here we have plotted the total neutrino mass sum, then the logarithms of the scale factor of the phase transition, and omega lambda. And you can see that for this model, the cosmological neutrino mass bound is significantly weakened. So this is the standard cosmological bound. I'm not sure if you can see it from the back because it's really small in this plot. And then it is weakened to 6.6 eV, which was our upper limit for this run. And at the same time, we see that when much smaller values of omega lambda are allowed, and that is because this combination of the neutrino component and the false vacuum energy is very degenerate with a cosmological constant in this model. And then we also see that this scale factor of the phase transition, that this peaks at a value of today. And so, and that is probably because of two reasons. So one is if you have a very early time of the scale factor of the phase transition, that this false vacuum energy would be then dominant over the cosmological constant. So there are constraints on this. So if we have a very late value of AS, this is a subdominant component then. And also the other thing is that when you think of this previous plot, that higher neutrino masses are allowed for late time data combination. So this is exactly what also shows up here in this constraint. So these results could be then interesting, for example, for the Katrin experiment that that has been built in Germany, because as I told you before, this experiment has a lower sensitivity of 200 millielectron volt for the electron neutrino mass. Now, if the cosmological upper limit is significantly weakened, this could make it much more likely that Katrin can actually discover neutrino masses. And then there is another experiment planned in Princeton at the moment that aims to detect the relic neutrino background. And this has will have a resolution of around 150 millielectron volt. And that means that in the standard case, where the upper limit is 120 millielectron volt, it would also be hard for this experiment to detect something. And in our case, because the limit is so much higher, it could be that we could detect a relic neutrino background with this experiment if it is built. Then, apart from that, we also wanted to see how the cosmological parameter tensions change for this model, again, if the tensions don't come from systematic effects. So in this plot, you can see the sigma 8 omega m constraints for different data sets, in this case for lambda CDM, with a fixed neutrino mass sum of 60 millielectron volt in this case. So this, the green one, is weak gravitational lensing from a kilo degree survey. Then this is Planck CMB, including polarization. Then this is Planck CMB lensing. And the yellow one is Planck SZ cluster counts with a BBN constraint on omega variance. And then we included here in the right plot also the total neutrino mass sum. So we allowed the total neutrino mass sum to vary here as well. And you see that the weak lensing counters shift a bit to the bottom along the degeneracy line. And that these Planck CMB counters, that they broaden along the degeneracy line. And that is because massive neutrinos suppress structure formation. Therefore, smaller values of sigma 8 are allowed. And because of the neutrino masses, larger values of omega m are allowed. And then we looked at what happens in a 4-hour model, and this is shown in the right-hand side plot here. So you can see that mostly blank lensing and the CMB is affected here, but kids weak lensing and asset cluster counts not so much. And that is because this model mostly changes the early evolution of neutrinos, and for these late time probes, the neutrinos have already obtained their mass, therefore the constraints are very similar to before. So you can see that this gets very broad, but still it does not really solve the tension. So there's maybe a very slight overlap here, but if you compare the values of S8, you see that there's no improvement in the discrepancies.
So can I ask, it's super cool, you have one extra parameter compared to the neutrino model.
Yes.
So yeah, okay, yes.
And some of the masses.
Right? So compared to this model has one new free parameter, which is AS. Yeah. And now I want to talk about future surveys, so mostly concentrating on galaxy clustering and galaxy shear, and the question whether relativistic effects relevant for these surveys could actually affect our neutrino and dark energy constraints. So when we look into the sky and observe the number of galaxies, the number of observed galaxies is not really the true underlying number of galaxies. That is because of a number of different effects. So one of them it comes from redshift space distortions. Then there is an effect accounting for lensing magnification. And then there are general relativistic corrections. So this lensing, so here we concentrate mostly on these two terms, so on lensing magnification and on the general relativistic corrections. So lensing magnification means that will affect this in two different ways. So one is that it magnifies the amount of galaxies that we observe, and also lensing changes the amount of galaxies that we observe. And then there are a couple of general relativistic corrections. For example, there's one that corresponds to the Shapiro time delay and one that corresponds to the ISW effect. And in this plot, you can see the scales on which these effects become relevant. So this red line here is redshift space distortion. So that's the most important effect here. Then we have lensing magnification here, which becomes dominant for very large L. And then we have the general relativistic corrections here, and they are mostly relevant for very small L. So here we were mostly interested in two different questions. So one is, if you include these effects, how much does it improve parameter constraints, for example, for the total neutrino mass sum and dark energy parameters? And then the other question is, if you neglect them, is this safe, or does this lead to a large bias on, for example, on the neutrino parameters? And the way we looked at this was with a Fisher matrix forecasting algorithm. So the Fisher matrix tells us for a given experimental setup how large will be the standard deviations of our parameters. So how well will we be able to measure, for example, the total neutrino mass sum given this Gland experiment. So this perturbation in the number counts that I have shown to you before then feeds into the power spectra CLs. And from these, you can obtain the Fisher matrix here, but also depends on the fraction of the sky observed. And then from the Fisher matrix, you can calculate the standard deviations of the parameters. And in a similar way, it is possible then to calculate the bias on the parameters. So by multiplying the Fisher matrix by a vector which has a similar form as the Fisher matrix here. And that also includes the difference in the CLs. So for example, let's think we want to compute the bias from neglecting lensing magnification. Then in that case, we would compute two different sets of CLs. So the observed or true CLs would be the power spectra computed when we include lensing. And then the theoretical CLs would be the power spectra computed when we neglect lensing magnification. So for our forecast, we looked mostly at two different experiments. So one is LSST, so the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, and also CMB Stage 4. And we used the multi-tracer approach that allows to forecast simultaneously for multiple tracers of the density field at the same time and to beat cosmic variance with this. And we looked at two combinations of tracers. So one set galaxy clustering alone, so galaxy clustering from LSST, and one for the combination of galaxy clustering with galaxy shear, CMB, and CMB lensing. And again, we looked at dark energy and neutrino parameters because it had been shown before that this lensing magnification effect is relevant for exactly these parameters. And as I told you before, neutrino and dark energy parameters can be degenerate with each other, and therefore it makes sense to look at both of them at the same time. And these are some of our results for lensing magnification. These yellow ellipses are for galaxy clustering alone, and the blue ones are for the combination of all tracers. So galaxy clustering combined with galaxy shear, CMB, and CMB lensing. And so you can see that in the case of galaxy clustering, including lensing magnification improves very slightly the parameter constraint. So this is the dashed line here. But the effect is not really big. And then for the combination of all tracers, we see that that we can't really see a difference when we include lensing magnification here. And then
measuring lensing magnification like that. Sorry, I think I missed that.
Sorry.
So how are you measuring lensing magnification?
So we include lensing magnification in terms of the magnification bias.
Right, in terms of actually getting the magnification in each place in the sky, correlating with something.
So you make some assumptions about the forecast for how your luminosity function looks like, and then you quantify what the magnification bias is, and then from that you obtain how large this lensing magnification term is. Then
you're just measuring the number counts, part of the number.
Yes, exactly.
Right, but to tell that there has been a magnification bias on the actual
theory prediction of what it should be.
That's right.
It's not a lensing number, just the number counts. You get more galaxies in places that are not.
I understand how it works. I'm just wondering, I'm just puzzled about how it's affecting the Fisher matrix controversy, because she's including it or not.
So then it goes in the CLs, right?
Yes.
So that's a measure of how much it's affecting the CLs, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so you're not actually trying to measure the amount of lensing. You're just saying, I've included it in my prediction or not.
Yeah.
Right, but maybe you should try to actually measure how much lensing has occurred. Right. So if you cross-correlate, for example, your galaxies with foreground galaxies, you can try to back out how much lensing has occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And presumably that would be a better way of doing this, right?
Maybe.
This is an LSST prediction, right?
Sure.
That doesn't keep it in the right way. Actually, let me try to understand this. So the CLs are just CLs have a given vegetable size, you don't cross-correlate different vegetable sizes?
I'm not sure. I think we don't.
I guess that's the point
to look
that
up.
Again, you could get more information, especially for lens, and you could cross-correlate the
Yeah, I think this is something some people in Oxford are looking at right now. But we have more time. Yeah, so what I wanted to say is that you can also see here the bias from neglecting lensing magnification. So this is the bias for galaxy clustering alone, and this is the bias for when you combine all tracers. So this would mean that, for example, so this is the fiduciary value, and then this whole ellipse would be then centered around this bias instead. So this is how the Fischer ellipses would move. And you can see that the bias here is of the order of a few standard deviations, so it is significant. And as I just said, the lensing magnification term depends on this parameter called magnification bias, that basically tells you how steep the luminosity function is. So because you can imagine that, for example, you can observe some galaxies until a certain magnitude, and then because of lensing magnification, you can observe an, a few galaxies that would just have been too faint to observe. Now, if this function is steeper, you can observe just a bit more galaxies that would have otherwise been too faint to observe. And therefore, this lensing magnification depends on how steep the slope actually is. In this table, you can see our results, so the allowed uncertainties of the magnification bias in order to avoid a bias just from this that is as high as one standard deviation. So you can see here that we need to know this magnification bias to at least 5% in order to avoid a bias of one standard deviation already. So that basically means that you need to know this magnification bias as precisely as possible, because otherwise you can already obtain a large bias just from this. And in this table, I have written down the effect from the general relativistic corrections. And I have not plotted this because in a plot you would not see much because the effects are so small. So you can see that the improvement from including these general relativistic corrections is below the percent level here. So for both data combinations, and then the bias from neglecting these effects is at the percent level as well. So they are, it's in most cases it is safe to neglect these effects. There's one exception, and that is primordial non-Gaussianity. For primordial non-Gaussianity, we saw that we can actually get a bias of half a standard deviation. So to summarize, I have talked about that time-varying dark energy can mimic the cosmological behavior of neutrinos and therefore affect neutrino mass constraints and constraints on the effect number of neutrinos. Then that time-varying neutrino masses cannot solve the the sigma 8 omega matter discrepancies. However, that it can weaken the cosmological neutrino mass bound. And then that lensing magnification can bias constraints of the total neutrino mass sum, and that therefore it should be taken into account. So thank you for your attention.
So now I want to come back to Neil's question. So given that it does induce a significant bias, how do we model that bias? How do we measure it independently to remove it?
I think you probably need to make sure that you measure this luminosity function as precisely as possible, and then make sure that you just include the lensing magnification term in your analysis for example, their versions of class where this is already included.
And just from my naivete, like, how does one do that given that you want the famous things and you're kind of wanting to measure the things that you would not otherwise see if there was not lensing? I mean, basically, is that the right physical picture?
My feeling is just that you need to measure this luminosity function as precisely as you can.
But the famous things, there aren't too many of them. I don't think they would give you too much statistics.
There's more of them than the brighter ones, right?
Well, depends on how far it's
faint,
I guess. But if there are enough of them, then you can measure the luminosity function. If there are enough of them, then I guess you can measure it. But I guess I'm a bit surprised that, I mean, it seems that it's natural to include the cross-correlation
on different latitudes.
But I guess in the latitudes,
you have the metric on the latitudes.
Yeah, I'm not completely sure. I will look it up.
That would be the way to
word,
because basically they have everything is lensed, but everything in front. It's the things that are in on the back are lensed, but things in front.
So that imbues it.
That's how actually it's measured, right?
Yeah.
So
it's on your forecasts, you know, for this like bias from the magnetic vision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so do you also marginalize over the galaxy bias?
Mm.
And by bias here, I mean running
mm-hmm.
also the, well, okay, yeah, you know, okay.
I think we have marginalized over it.
I guess I'm still like puzzled at that, like the origin of this bias on the cosmological parameters from the, but okay, yeah, we can talk more
mm-hmm.
about it. I mean, if just do that, you add extra clustering because of the magnification.
Right, and so one way to get extra clustering also just is to change the bias.
Right.
And so if you normalize over that, then I'm puzzled.
Yeah, I think we for each redshift bin, we had a different bias which we might generalize.
Yeah.
So I have a, I guess going back to the first model we discussed, this, I guess, space transition in neutrinos, I guess what we saw was, years ago, is basically whatever that's responsible for the phase transition, basically we show that there's a phase transition, but then the thing that there's a structure of the phase transition, so in fact, you never get a homogeneous path of neutrino, you get these bubbles or these
mm-hmm.
bubbles of neutrino nuggets. They always contain relativistic neutrinos and they're kind of separated, they would never merge. And I guess the thing is, I guess you're expecting a different physics, but whatever is responsible for that physics would do other things. And it's
it would be good to think about that.
And what kind of other thing?
Like what we saw, there could be feed forces, or neutrinos could cluster more than
mm-hmm.
expect.
So what is the distance between the numbers?
Yeah.
That they would cluster more than.
Yeah. So you have the self-interaction. So I think it's kind of magic.
That's right.
Yeah. So we neglected in the simulations for simplicity because we just wanted to focus on the division.
Right.
That they will cluster. They will self-annihilate. They will annihilate self-interaction.
Right. So that.
And you will get like new particles in the spectrum that mediate
mm-hmm.
like. And all
this
stuff, because this is all part of the model.
Okay, so good. So that's what that
is.
So that will probably happen, and that could be as, in principle, could be as big as the effects.
What was the,
because
there was Maymon's curves. So what would be happening with
the phase versus the second phase of curves? So, these are. I think Maymon is like perturbative, and I guess your model is much more complicated. You cannot write the phase right. But it's non perturbative, right? It takes
itself
to a
phase
transition. Yeah.
So before this, there was an earlier story by the new one.
The one that Christian mentioned is mass spiral neutrinos from 2003.
Yeah.
And then there was the problem that again, Matthias said, the big cluster and all of that. And it was easy to track it down. And this seems similar, except that you're saying how probably it happens a problem because of the phase transition.
In our case, it happens in a very late time, so it's peaking at A equal 1. So this is something that, so I don't know, like, I don't know the mass variant model.
The mass variant model, it was a scalar field that was rolling, and then it kind of controlled the mass of the neutrino. So everything happened more gradually, at least in the original model. But then we showed that as soon as, at some point, in fact, there is a phase transition that basically has neutrinos become relativistic, everything clusters into these knobs.
But this phase transition is probably much earlier than this. Because
I think it's model dependent.
Are there any more questions? Okay, so if not, then let us thank the speaker.